Hi, my name is Sarah Tran.
And this is Megha Jan.
And we
are Technology.
So what flavor of tea are you drinking today?
Okay, this one's gonna shock you. I'm drinking Moringa tea today. It's something that my mom got me hooked on, actually. Have you ever had it before?
I don't think I have.
Okay, it's honestly a lot like matcha, but it tastes a little weirder. I feel like it's a little grainier, but that just might be because it's homemade. Anyways, what about you? What kind of tea are you drinking, Sarah?
I really do wish that I had some ginger tea right now, because that would be the most ironic thing ever since we are talking about the presidential election. But anyways, speaking of not ginger, I'm drinking some green tea right now.
Yeah, that's great. Today is Tuesday, November 17th.
And now that Biden has been officially declared as the president-elect, we're doing a really cool episode about all of the business and tech tea.
Right. So basically, we're trying to assess what is going to happen in the coming years with Biden as president and the Senate being majority Republican.
But I guess to start off, one of the first things that I want to talk about is actually Biden's unique, like, imagine air quotations here, unique transitional committee. And according to the Center for Responsive Politics, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Microsoft collectively gave more than $10 million to Biden's race.
That's really interesting, because I think some people predicted that almost wouldn't happen, just because, as we know, Dems are for a bigger role of government within tech and various other aspects of the way we live our life. So why do you think this was the case?
I think one of the reasons actually is almost extrinsic to Biden as a candidate. And it's kind of addressing that exactly, right? Like, why would big tech companies be in favor of a blue candidate who is probably going to enforce more regulations, which we'll talk about later in this episode? But it's also to see and kind of address the controversy we see with President Donald Trump in the past couple of years, as well as just as the election has been continuing, and then with Twitter and just all of the sort of things that have been happening. It almost seems like these big tech companies are voting for Biden or helping out Biden's side just because they didn't like the other opposition.
Right. So, Sarah, you just touched upon some really interesting topics that we want to further break down for our audience today. You know, Biden won, now what? Like, what does this mean for our future, for big tech? What does it mean for business regulations? So we're going to do this in a variety of ways.
To begin, we'll first go over what are the impacts on social media. Then we'll look at antitrust laws and big tech mergers and possible acquisitions. Then we'll look at immigration, public equity, and VC, and finally wrap up with energy and sustainability.
Let's get started by talking about social media, specifically Section 230. Sarah, have you ever heard of Section 230 before?
To be honest, not before this election and doing a little bit of research for this episode, of course.
Right. So I feel like a lot of people are unfamiliar with this certain clause, essentially, but some context on it. Its roots are bipartisan itself. It was actually introduced by a Democratic senator from Oregon and a former representative from California, who's Republican. And the whole objective of it is to protect social media platforms from being held liable for user-generated content. And while that seems great because it is all about freedom of speech and social media platforms not obstructing it, there are a lot of Democrats as well as conservatives that believe, this is a really rare point of agreement for them actually, that it should be rolled back.
Yeah, I remember seeing this one line from Biden, and he said something like, for Section 230, he says that it should be revoked, comma, immediately should be revoked. And this was actually kind of a dig at Mark Zuckerberg, and he explicitly mentioned that. It's really interesting because just today, when this episode is being recorded on November 16th, Obama had this release, and he basically said that these tech companies and social media firms should actually be more like editorials rather than just open platforms for anybody to use. And I was like, that's a really hot take, Obama. What do you think about that, Mega?
That is a really hot take. But when it comes to social media platforms being treated like publishers, we're talking about social media almost turning into Wikipedia, right? Where instead of, you know, just letting anyone tweet whatever they want or post whatever they want on Facebook, you now have entire teams that are not only fact-checking and flagging things like Twitter and Facebook already do, but rather going in and possibly even editing user-generated content to better fit their image. And I think that almost enters this area of constitutional rights, but also just a general gray line where you're like, what is social media really at its essence, right? So should social media be regulated? And then should it be exactly like, you know, a publisher? Or does social media exist independently of such practices?
Yeah, so I guess that kind of brings up my question for you. And it's really interesting to compare publishing companies that, for example, like the New York Times, which is primarily, you know, human run, human narrated, to something like a social media company, because so much of what happens is not just behind closed doors, but quite literally behind closed algorithms. And so I guess with that AI and all these various technical components that are associated with social media, do you think that necessarily lends itself to either making social media as more of like a publishing platform, like an editorial, or just something that's like an open source platform for anybody?
I think that's a really great question. And it really depends on the complexity of the algorithms and the AI being used itself, right? Because the more accurate it is, I feel like it almost becomes human-like, where it is like you have a backroom of publishers sitting there. Kind of similar to what we talked about a few episodes ago with Factmata, you know, referring back to our October 13th Elect Tech episode, which you guys, shameless plug, should go ahead and check out if you haven't. But yeah, I mean, Factmata is also a startup that uses AI-powered tools to basically regulate content. And I guess a lot of social media websites do this in a similar way. But I think if you purely look at the algorithms and forget the fact that oftentimes there are like rooms of people who are working with these algorithms to either train them or kind of guard them or correct the mistakes that they make, I would say that it's really tough, because sometimes you're also bringing in like this human aspect of bias in it, which I think is very human publisher like.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about something like TikTok, if you, the technology team, remember that episode we had about TikTok and just all of those really famous and iconic lines we had where people were talking about how addicting and how precise these algorithms were, it almost becomes hard to say that like these social media companies aren't publishers, because the algorithms in a way are crafting content for the users.
That's actually a really good point.
Yeah, I actually was reading this article, and it was published just today, November 16th, and Obama was talking about a similar concept about how, you know, whether we like it or not, these social media companies are creating silos of information for us as users. And, you know, that can even, and it has led to things like, you know, denial of facts. It has led to things such as like believing in wild conspiracy theories. And it quite honestly just has opened up so many niche discussions that it's almost hard to regulate and see where those conversations are going.
Which is kind of why even within like this collaboration that Democrats and conservatives have in terms of forming Section 230 and now wanting to roll it back, conservatives seem to be more gung-ho on making it happen, because they firmly believe that the bias that has been introduced in you know, flagging tweets currently and fact-checking information is leaning towards Democrats, which if we look at the data and the fact, as Sarah mentioned earlier, that big tech overwhelmingly supported Democrats in this election, it might actually be true. But kind of on that note, something really interesting, you know, food for thought, everyone, about 230 is that social media platforms, even with 230 in place, are already able to moderate potentially harmful content. and they can even flag presidential tweets. They can, you know, take off really, really harmful things such as posts by terrorist organizations and even child pornography. So if we were to roll back Section 230 and force these social media companies to crack down on the content on their platform, what are we really asking them to do?
Wow, that is such a big open-ended question that I'm really having a hard time just thinking about what would I do if I was in the position to make those executive decisions.
Right. So if you guys have anything to add to this conversation, feel free to tweet at us. We're at Technology1 on Twitter, or comment on our Instagram at technology.podcast and send us your thoughts. But with that, I think it's time to move on to talking about antitrust laws and big tech mergers, because I think if we could change our podcast name to anything, it would probably be the antitrust podcast, because that's literally what we started this podcast by talking about. That was our first episode.
Yeah, we have like this antitrust magic going on, because I don't know, whether we're talking about startups, which are the pretty much like the opposite side of antitrust laws, we always find a way to talk about this topic.
Yes, and as Sarah and I were discussing a few weeks ago, business itself is all about trust. And this pandemic is real, but you know, it is all about being trustworthy. So antitrust almost has a double meaning, in that it's not just about, you know, breaking up monopolies, but it's also about rebuilding trust with consumers and users of these large companies. But even though this is such an important topic, and as we've noticed, kind of an omniscient topic when it comes to big tech, antitrust was not actually that big of a focus of Biden's campaign.
Yeah, so in terms of thinking about where exactly is Biden's administration going to be navigating the world of antitrust and big tech laws, we can kind of get some implications, some reference to the Obama administration, because there are some, you know, obviously there's influences and they do share a lot of similar political opinions, but also there's some research done by Gi-hee Son, a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law and Policy. And he actually says that he expects the administration in terms of antitrust enforcement to be more along the lines of the Obama administration. And something unique that the Obama administration did actually was it didn't allow T-Mobile and Sprint to merge, as well as Time Warner and Comcast. And these are just really big companies that are in similar verticals. So it shows that potentially Biden will not allow for these type of multi-million, if not billion-dollar mergers and acquisitions.
Right. To some extent, Dems and conservatives also agree on breaking up large tech companies or large companies, large service providers, such as, you know, Time Warner and Comcast themselves. So kind of with that comes this aspect of realizing that while, you know, Biden is going to be a Democratic president, the Senate is Republican, and they may kind of push back against this aspect of big tech. So talking about, breaking down monopolies and building trust brings us to a really important topic regarding a certain country that starts with a C and happens to be halfway across the world from us. Of course, I'm talking about China and specifically the Sino-US trade war. So the Sino-US trade war started during the Trump presidency with President Trump placing a lot of tariffs on Chinese imports, and then China kind of retaliating and it becoming an escalation of tariffs both of the countries were placing on each other. But it not only hurt China, it also hurt us in the process. And it hurt a lot of Trump's voter base in the Midwest, which might be a reason why he wasn't reelected. And despite all of this drama happening in the past 4 years, the trade war, surprisingly to a lot of people, did not necessarily have roots during this administration. Its roots extend far beyond that, because even during the Obama administration, Obama was trying to bring China to order in a very subtle way. He actually went to court in the World Trade Organization. And there was a 3-year-long trial against China because it claimed that China was, you know, stealing intellectual property from American companies, and they were not playing by the rules of international trade. But at the end of the day, China just got away with a slap on its wrist. It was a fine of a few $1 million, and that was really nothing for a country as massive as China. So after this entire debacle, Trump decided to be more aggressive, take the stance, and ultimately we're here with an escalating trade war, and, you know, hundreds of millions in tariffs. But Biden, it seems that he will only continue to place pressure on China, maybe not in the same way. He probably won't have, you know, all of these tariffs and an escalating trade war, but he has promised to bring in allies and continue placing pressure specifically on Chinese companies. And maybe we can even see a change in TikTok status, because while Trump claims he's, you know, really strict on China and Chinese companies, he let TikTok get away with a simple acquisition by Oracle, an American company. But those servers still belong to the CCP, or the Chinese Communist Party. Maybe with Biden, this won't happen.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. And to be honest, I'm not really sure what the future is going to look like, especially in regards to China, Biden, the US, and tech. But I do have one sort of stipulation here, and that's that we're going to see a growth in a lot of these East Asian, so specifically like China, a lot of these emerging markets. And I think one of those reasons why is actually because now that China has been forced to almost become its own technological powerhouse and retain a lot of its in-house talent, it almost seems like they're going to be able to rapidly advance at a speed that the US may or may not be prepared for. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
You know, Sarah, it's really interesting that you mentioned in-house talent, because I think that perfectly ties into kind of what we wanted to talk about next, which is brain drain and immigration, specifically brain drain from Asian countries. I mean, to be perfectly candid, brain drain is the reason that I am here in this country today. My dad came here as an immigrant working in the IT sector on an H-1B visa. So understandably, I was personally a little excited to hear the news that Biden administration is actually planning on expanding the cap on H-1B visas. And currently the cap is at 140,000. I'm not sure how much they're going to expand it by. They haven't released numbers on that yet. Essentially, an H-1B visa, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the United States immigration process, is for specialized workers, mainly in STEM fields, and especially in information technology. And furthermore, kind of what happens is that these people bring in like new sets of specialized skills that help our economy grow and help the tech sector expand from a variety of new perspectives. But another thing that a lot of these immigrants end up doing is pursuing education within the United States of America. So basically, the new immigration policy that Biden is going to release will also eliminate the cap for international students who are getting PhDs in America. And this is mainly going to happen in STEM fields. And these particular students are actually projected to generate a lot of economic income for the country in the coming decade.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about how the US is potentially going to change the way that we approach talent as a whole, especially in the tech field. And now that we've kind of talked about this from a macro international lens, looking at the influence of foreign countries, we're going to transition more and talk more about what are some of the impacts, the macroeconomic impacts of Biden on the economy. So specifically, we're going to talk about like public equity and venture capital.
Yeah, to get started, something really interesting we noticed right after Biden was declared to be the projected winner of this election was that big tech stocks actually ended up doing even better. And there was kind of a surge in their value. And it seemed that even though a lot of news reports were being released at the time saying that Biden would probably bring in more regulation, there was kind of a minimal impact on the stocks themselves, or a minimal negative impact. In fact, you know, the night of the election itself, things were really tumultuous, and tech stocks in the S&P 500 dropped by nearly 4 to 7% before Biden was declared the winner.
And so outside of the tech range for a second, just to talk about some of the business trends that we see going on, if we look at crude oil prices, so CL is the name of the ticker, if you're following the stocks by any chance, this is probably the only area as of now that we can see that isn't necessarily bulling right now in the stock market. And it makes a lot of sense because Biden is a Democrat and probably will enforce some more restrictions in this regards, especially to forms of oil that aren't necessarily beneficial for the environment. And Biden has actually said that he plans to ban new oil and natural gas drilling permits on federal land. So this is a really big change in this regard.
That is really interesting, actually. And I'd love to hear more about how exactly this ties into the other aspect of it, which is
my favorite topic, VC. And here we see that there is possibly going to be a shift, and Biden's new tax plan would actually tax long-term capital gains as ordinary income for people earning more than $1 million per year. So prior to Biden, investors would actually pay a lower capital gains tax on some of the proceeds that they would earn from the fund's investments. So for any of you guys who are entrepreneurs who are interested in VC or just the private equity side of things, this is definitely something to keep an eye out on if you do happen to make more than $1 million per year.
Yes, honestly, I doubt anyone listening to your podcast makes over $1 million a year. But if you do, thanks for listening. And we will be opening a Patreon very soon. So hopefully we'll secure that bag. But moving on from Sarah's favorite topic to my favorite topic and our final topic of discussion regarding the changes that are going to happen in big tech as well as business regulations after this win for Biden, is energy and sustainability, which has just been such an important and all-encompassing aspect of scientific innovation in this country. But going kind of into the policy part of it, climate change was ranked as one of the highest priority issues by Biden voters, and Biden will really be taking that to heart. As we know, the U.S. has formally withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement as of this year, but Biden is going to try to reverse that. And he's going to immediately begin by, first of all, making domestic changes and reversing a lot of Trump's moves against climate change regulations. Then again, this sounds great in theory, but in reality, the Senate is still Republican. So there is a good chance that this might actually never truly go through. Not to disappoint, though, because AI research does have a pretty good forecast in the sense that currently, President Trump's 2021 budget was about $142.2 billion being spent on federal R&D. But the White House is estimating to bring that up to $300 billion. Now, this is for overall R&D. What does this mean for AI research itself? Well, the White House actually back in February said that it would bump non-defense related AI investment to $2 billion annually by 2022. But this was seen as very little by a lot of analysts and AI researchers themselves. So the Biden campaign stated that they were going to try to increase that budget significantly because they believe that this is hollowing out the American middle class. And they want to invest in key technologies like 5G, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, as well as the clean vehicle or EV industry.
Yeah, it's always really exciting to hear when overall R&D spending is increasing because that's how you know, like in the next year or so, we're going to see a ton of technological innovation.
Right. And rightfully so. I mean, this is the best time for it, considering we are in a pandemic. There's some good news about, you know, that Pfizer vaccine coming through. Hopefully we'll be talking about that soon on an episode. But, you know, we really need more robust R&D in this country if we want to be able to compete with other players such as China, for example. And something else that kind of ties into that is energy infrastructure itself, because reports from these past few years have detailed just how poor energy infrastructure and energy defense mechanisms even in America have become. We're ranked as a D- when it comes to energy infrastructure. And that includes energy storage, energy transportation. So when you see a rating of D-, that essentially means that our energy systems are not efficient enough to really carry through all the loads and fulfill the real demand that people have in this country. And it's scary knowing that, because we are not only losing so much energy, but with an increase in climate change, an increase in natural disasters annually, that potentially means that when people really need their energy, there's not enough in the grid for them. And there's not a way of transporting that from other areas that have a lot of stored energy. So kind of taking that into account, something great that's going to happen with this administration, if Biden is to pass executive orders on this, is a $2 trillion investment in clean energy infrastructure and community development. And hopefully within the next 4 years, we can start seeing some tangible changes in this area.
Yeah, that's really scary.
Yeah, that's kind of like a doomsday scenario, right? But I feel like if we don't think of things in that way, then it's going to be hard to compete with other countries that are able to manage their energy systems a lot better than we are.
So that pretty much wraps up this episode. We've covered a lot, everything from big tech to sustainability to immigration to education to international policy. I definitely do think it's one of those things that was really called for, and I'm really glad that we're having this conversation.
Right. I mean, we waited 2 whole weeks to make sure that the election results were really in and we can tell what was going on definitively, just so we could record this episode for you guys. But if you guys have any of your own takes, hot takes or cold takes, or just want to spill some tea about what you think is going to happen in the next 4 years of this presidency, as well as this divided government in terms of big tech and business regulation, please once again feel free to tweet at Technology1 on Twitter. And, drop in a check by our Instagram, which is at technology.podcast.
But rest assured, however these next 4 years turn out, whether they're wild or they're tranquil, we will be covering all the biz and tech news as always.
Thank you so much for joining us on this lovely Tuesday. We'll see you next Tuesday with some more spillable content.